Hi, and welcome to another episode of Economist Corner, a CETA podcast where leading thinkers break down the latest news and policy updates. I'm Jared Ball, Chief Economist of CETA, the Committee for Economic Development of Australia. Yesterday, the ABS released its labour force statistics for August. The results show a continuation of trends from June. While unemployment decreased by 0.1%, this is mostly due to fewer Australians looking for work. The impact of the New South Wales lockdowns have started to materialise more clearly in this release, with significant falls in employment, hours worked, and the participation rate. So what should we make of these figures, and do we need to shift our policy mix to adapt to the worsening labour market? I discussed these questions with Professor Jeff Borland. He's a Trueby Williams Professor of Economics at the University of Melbourne and a Director of CETA. But first, I'm joined by CETA CEO Melinda Salento to discuss the labour market and some of the other issues we've been thinking about at CETA this week. Hi, Melinda.
Hi, Jared. I hope you're ready to explain these crazy numbers to me.
Obviously leave that to the expert. Jeff Borland, but clearly there's already a lot of explaining going on social media and in the news. Clearly the unemployment rate itself is not the beacon of the labour market that it used to be, given the current kind of COVID circumstances. And I did see one, I think Joe Masters from EY was saying that if the participation rate was what it was a few months ago in New South Wales, you'd have a unemployment rate in New South Wales of 10% at the moment. So clearly a number of people dropping out of the labour force numbers for whatever reason at the moment, which is helping to keep the unemployment rate at bay. But we are seeing some significant falls in hours worked. So that's probably the better beacon at the moment, but I'm sure Jeff will have more to say about that. You've had an interesting week, Melinda. On Monday, you hosted the Beyond the Jab live stream with Professor Peter Doherty and also Professor Raina McIntyre. That was a pretty interesting discussion that I tuned into. What were your kind of key takeouts in terms of where we are on the kind of process of vaccination and opening up and living with the virus?
Yeah, well, maybe a similar message to what you were just delivering, Jared, in that you sort of have to look beneath the headlines and the conversation is a lot more nuanced than I think sometimes plays out, particularly in the media. There's been so much focus on what happens when we get to, first vax 70%, 80%, second vax 70%, 80%. And I think there's almost a sense that when we get to these levels, then great, we'll have the great reopening party and, maybe Freedom Day like they've had in the UK. But there's just so much more to consider. There are going to be lots of challenges still to come, really. And that I think, was the key message from both Professor Doherty and Professor McIntyre. One, vaccines are the only answer here, but even when we have them, we're not going to have 100% of the population fully vaccinated. As we start to open up, there will be cases, there will be hospitalizations, there will be deaths. We are going to have to keep doing some of the things that we've become so accustomed to now, wearing masks, social distancing, but also thinking about some new things like ventilation. It was a little bit sobering, I have to say, if I could sum it up that way.
Yeah, no, I think that's spot on. I would describe it as a bit of a reality check, and certainly, as you say, the need for deploying multiple tools to stay COVID safe in the months ahead, and also perhaps just recognition that this virus is changing all the time, and modelling can't keep up with that. Modeling's, as we know from economic modeling, it's always making assumptions. And the issue is that things are changing so rapidly that assumptions that are made on one day are out the window the next day. So, I also thought from an economic perspective, it just suggests that while everyone's expecting rightly that the December quarter we'll see a bounce back in economic activity. That's pretty much inevitable. I think the nature and magnitude of that bounce back will be quite different to what we saw last year, because we're not certainly on the East Coast going back to a world of zero COVID like we were last year. So I think that presents some additional challenges.
Yeah, look, Darren, I think the other thing too that relates very much to how we think about the economy and even the labour market is going to be, you know, multiple speeds, if you like, or different experiences across the states. And I think that's becoming increasingly evident too, that, you know, I think it's more reasonable to expect that a state like WA remains more closed than open for the foreseeable future. And I think that's just going to shape how we talk about our economy, how we think about our economy. And we know that over the previous period of prosperity that people were moving around an awful lot, and that helped underpin the strength of our economy. And I think what we're talking about for the next couple of years at least is a very different scenario.
Well, another area where we're going to see multiple speeds, as we've already been suggesting, is in the labour market. And one of those areas is obviously around the shift to work from home and hybrid working that we've seen. And that obviously certainly benefits more than others some jobs that can be done remotely. The Productivity Commission has a research paper out today on working from home. I know you've had a look at it. What's it telling us about the work from home experience in Australia and what we're likely to see in the years ahead?
Well, kind of continuing in this vein of experimentation, if you like, we're going to be experimenting with opening up and vaccination rates. You know, we've had this great work from home experiment, and, you know, I think most wouldn't have expected that we would handle it as well as we have. But I think the big question now is what is the longer term implication of this? And what are some of the issues and questions that we're going to have to think a little bit more deeply about? I think a lot of what was in the Productivity Commission report was probably not unexpected. We've been having a lot of these conversations over the last 12 months. You know, roughly 40% of workers have jobs that allow them to work from home, give or take. And, you know, that most of them probably want to continue to be able to work from home a little bit in the future, but not entirely as we have done for the last year or so. I think a couple of the issues that we need to think about is what's good about that and where are the challenges that sit with that. And the report sort of draws out some opportunities. Being able to work from home is helpful for some people who've faced barriers to labour force participation in the past. So people with caring responsibilities, parents of young kids, people with disabilities, and people who've lived in locations where there aren't a lot of jobs around them. So that's you know, an opportunity for those people to lift their job prospects, basically. But the other side of the coin, if you like, is that the jobs that are most able to be work from home tend to be at higher income levels, and associated with higher levels of education and qualifications. So that's probably the other side of the coin, if you like, in terms of these arrangements favouring you know, higher income workers and people who are really qualified. So both things I think we've got to keep an eye on, make the most of the good, and be thoughtful about what the implications of the sort of perhaps inequities that might emerge from it, what they are and how we can respond to them.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing the study in a few years' time that just reflects on what has actually happened and how those trends have come out, because it's going to be very interesting. All right. Well, I think it's a good time to hear from Jeff Borland on these labour market numbers. Thanks for joining us, Melinda, and I hope that you might get out for a picnic this weekend in Melbourne.
Well, that's it. I'm now at the stage where, you know, being able to go 10 kilometres rather than 5 kilometres from home is a cause for celebration. So picnics indeed. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Melinda. All right, Jeff, really good to have you on to be able to talk about yesterday's labour market numbers. And I guess, you know, last year we were perhaps pleasantly surprised when the unemployment rate didn't go as high as many of us feared. Of course, this time around with these lockdowns, we're seeing this strange, perverse kind of impact of the unemployment rate coming down, despite the fact that we're in lockdown. Can you just take us through some of the factors and mechanics of the labour market numbers that are actually driving what seems like an unlikely result?
Sure. Thanks, Jared. And yeah, thanks for the invitation to talk. Yeah, so as you're alluding to, different from last year, the fact that the unemployment rate's decreased in the last few months in Australia this time around isn't a cause for celebration. The unemployment rate's the ratio of the number of people unemployed to the number of people in the labour force, or the number of people who want to work. Usually the number of people who want to work with the labour force evolves, you know, quite slowly and incrementally. And so the reason the rate of unemployment changes is because of changes in the number of people who are unemployed, which reflects labour demand conditions. And so that's why traditionally we think of the rate of unemployment as an indicator of the state of demand in the labour market. But what we've seen in the last several months is that the rate of unemployment, and particularly in the last couple of months, has been driven by changes in the number of people wanting to work. And so rather than reflecting a strong labour market, it's reflecting people withdrawing from the labour market, reflecting a weak labour market. So if you look at the last month, employment fell by 146,000. And so you think, wow, that's going to translate into an increase in the rate of unemployment. But no, because 168,000 people actually moved out of the labour force. So the number of people who are unemployed fell by 22,000. So therefore, we've had this weird outcome where the rate of unemployment's actually fallen in the last month from 4.6 to 4.5. We can be pretty confident that decrease in labour supply is because of people thinking there aren't jobs available. Because, for example, in the last month, you know, virtually all the decrease in the labour force or the decrease in labour force in Australia was from New South Wales, where we've also seen the biggest impact of lockdown on hours worked. So it seems what's happening is we've got a weak labour market that's causing people to withdraw from thinking it's worthwhile looking for work, and that kind of paradoxically is raising the rate of unemployment.
And so when we do look across some of the broader indicators, and you've alluded to a weak labour market, when we look across some of the other indicators like the participation rate, like hours worked, what are you seeing in terms of the overall kind of state of the labour market?
Well, what you're seeing is, I say, sort of, if you want to understand in what's happening in the Australian labour market, you know, as it's been really, I guess, for the last sort of 18 months or so, follow the COVID trail. With the re-emergence of COVID since May, in the eastern states in particular, with New South Wales having to go into, Victoria first, I guess, in June. Victoria came out for a little while, but New South Wales then going in July. Basically, you're seeing the employment numbers driven by the impact of COVID. So in New South Wales, for example, if you compare back to May, which was sort of our labour market peak, monthly hours worked are now down 11.7%, which is a bigger decrease than New South Wales experienced from March to May in 2020 with the onset of COVID. So New South Wales is actually sort of in worse state now than it was, slightly worse state than it was back last year. Victoria and Queensland, they've also seen hours work go backwards in the last month, in the period since May. Victoria perhaps is a little bit of a surprise. If you look back to May, the decrease in hours is only about 2.8%. The last month down about 3.4%. Given the stringency of the lockdown in Victoria, if there's one thing that kind of maybe surprised me about this month's labour force figures, it was there wasn't sort of a larger decrease in Victoria. But that may be reflecting the shorter duration of the lockdown in Victoria than New South Wales. I guess it may reflect that the way the lockdown's been done has had less impact on employment. We'll know more about that, I guess, when we see the September numbers.
And just outside of obviously the lockdown states, anything interesting that you're seeing in any of the other states that aren't struck down by COVID at the present time?
Well, in Western Australia and South Australia, you've seen continued growth in monthly hours. Like, whether you look at the period from May to August or whether you look at the last month, you've had growth of about 1.5%. If you look the period to May, you've had growth around about 3%. Tasmania stayed about the same. It's interesting to look at those states to the extent that you think that they might represent what would have been happening in Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland if we hadn't gone back into lockdown. If you do have that interpretation, then I guess it's pretty interesting because it says that, back in May, we were wondering, how long can the economy keep growing as strongly as it is? Well, South Australia, Western Australia, if we kind of interpret them as sort of the story without COVID, show that there may well have been further growth in store for Victoria and New South Wales and Queensland and the Australian labour market, therefore.
Well, we'll try not to think about that too much with regret, Jeff. The other issue, of course, that everyone has been focused on has just been around the particular gender impacts that we see in the labour market when lockdowns occur. What are we seeing in terms of sort of the impact on male versus female at the moment?
Yeah, well, there is a real pattern, Jared, that every time, states have gone into lockdown. It happened back in, April 2020, sort of when all the states went into lockdown. It happened when Victoria went into its second lockdown. It happened again when New South Wales has gone into its lockdown. There seems to be, in the initial stages, the initial months, a more pronounced negative effect on females than males, which after sort of a while sort of equalises to some degree. But yeah, if you look again at the period from May to August, female employment down by a much larger amount than male employment, like 90,000 compared to 25,000. Females also withdrawing from the labour force in much larger numbers, about 40,000 more females out of the labour force than males. So there's this very sort of definite and a pattern that's sort of repeating in terms of there being a larger adverse effect on females than males, especially during the initial sort of phases of the lockdown. And it's also worth saying that another pattern we see is the larger effect on younger workers than older workers. Again, I guess because of the industry concentration of the impact of COVID on industries where young people are disproportionately employed. So if you look at the last month, young people 15 to 24 make up 15% of the population, but half the job losses in the last month were in that age group sort of. So we're seeing these recurring patterns sort of every time COVID reemerges. More pronounced impacts on females than males, more pronounced impact on younger than older workers.
So some similar kind of patterns repeating there. I guess the thing that is different this time when we compare to last year is, of course, the nature of government assistance. And in the case of New South Wales, we have natural disaster payments for individuals plus payroll assistance. But, of course, we don't have JobKeeper, which is leading to an ongoing debate around whether the current kind of arrangements are effective or not. And in addition, we don't have that same kind of additional kind of supplement in terms of job seeker for people who are unemployed. So do you think that the equation has changed at all in terms of the need for further government assistance, given what we're seeing in the labour market at the moment? Or do you think we can kind of make it through the rest of the year and hopefully pop out at the end in a stronger position?
Yeah, I think, I mean, yeah, it always depends on what the conditions are at the time. But I think sort of given the current outlook, we've got the policy about right. I think, you know, this time around, we had a better idea of, you know, I guess with vaccination coming along and that the duration of impact and the type of impact that there would be, the extent of impact on the labour market. And yeah, so I think the more targeted assistance is the appropriate way to go. More efficient, cost effective way to provide assistance to business to be able to start up again once they get out the other side if they're being impacted by COVID. Payments to workers who aren't getting work because of COVID. I think the more targeted approach this time around is appropriate and the way to go. Job seeker, I guess my comment there would be not so much with reference to this particular episode, but yeah, I'm on record as saying that I think that we need to go further than the $50 increase that there has the permanent $50 increase a week that there's been. I definitely think there could be policy movement in that area. I'd see it more as sort of a long-term strategy, but of course then that's going to be something that's of benefit during a period like this as well.
No, definitely. CEDA certainly agrees with you on the long-term adequacy of the job seeker payment. Always save the hardest questions for last, Jeff. I think you and I and lots of others were marvelling last year at just how quickly the labour market bounced back. And of course, this time, perhaps a little bit different because we're not going to be emerging back into a zero COVID world. We're going to be emerging into what Peter Doherty, I think earlier this week, called a bit of a big experiment in terms of what vaccination looks like and in terms of what ongoing outbreaks and infections sort of look like. What's your kind of outlook in terms of the capacity for the labour market to bounce back from the weak condition that it's in, and perhaps longer term, does this change anything around some of the judgments around the target rate of unemployment that policymakers should be targeting?
So on the snapback, I don't think these lockdowns are going to change the nature of what happens coming out of the lockdowns in the eastern Victoria, New South Wales in particular, dramatically. But I don't think it's not like we're going to go from, wow, last year we snapped back really, really quickly, whereas this year, you know, it's going to be a more traditional recession where it's going to take ages to come out. But on the other hand, I think, I'd probably be shifting, if you think of sort of putting probability on sort of different, outcomes, a probability on snapback, a probability on sort of a slightly sort of slower recovery, probability on really slow recovery, I probably wouldn't put any more weight on really slow recovery, but I'd probably adjust a little bit. I'd put a little bit less weight on really quick sort of snapback and a little bit more weight on, taking a little bit longer. Yeah, I think it comes back to, to me, the drivers are still the same sort of. It's like, okay, the COVID situation, as you said, I think the COVID situation is going to be a bit different than last year because we're going to be coming out not into a zero COVID environment where people felt safe to go out and do stuff again. We're going to be coming out into an environment where COVID's around, people are vaccinated, but you can still get ill sort of. And so, yeah, I think that it would be surprising if that didn't cause some more hesitancy in some consumption activities. I think the second factor is we know, the amount of government stimulus last year was massive. I think a question is how much residual effect of that stimulus there still is and sort of how that affects economic activity once we come out of the lockdowns. And yeah, last year, the obvious thing is we were all really worried about whether, whether the impact of COVID might spill over into a more general recession, whether, you know, effects on firm profits, effects on household incomes would lead this to being a more traditional type of recession. Didn't happen at all. But again, you wonder whether sort of to some degree there might be a little bit of that this time around. So I wouldn't be kind of changing my expectations about what the pattern of recovery will be hugely, but I'd probably be would not sort of expect that the snapback would be quite as quick as it was last year. But having said that, that's probably what I didn't think it would be slow recovery last year, but yeah, I, like many others, certainly didn't foresee how quick it would be. Like, the Australian labour market proved to be, and Australian economy proved to be, incredibly resilient last year. So that's why I'm sort of cautious in shifting the probability distribution too far away from it being a pretty strong recovery. On the other point, the target rate of unemployment. So yeah, as you'll know, that's something that I kind of have strong views about. I don't know that this recent episode changes our view on the target rate of unemployment. I think that's more of a long run issue. So my view is still that what we should be doing is going for a rate of unemployment initially in the low fours, and then depending on what happens to wage inflation, thinking about pushing even lower. I think, it now looks like we kind of meandered along with unemployment rate 5-6% in the 2010s, and we were doing that because maybe we were worried that if we went below that, we'd be causing wage inflation. I guess COVID seems to have brought together a whole lot of points, which have brought a general acceptance, sort of, which you see through Treasury and RBA revising their NIRAs, that in fact, the things have changed, that we can push for a lower rate of unemployment if we do that. We use more of our productive potential. We get a fairer distribution of income, and we can do it without causing wage inflation. Because, for example, I guess point I've made is, look, the rate of unemployment, it doesn't include underemployment. So it's only a partial and in fact, a diminishing representation of sort of a labor underutilization. If you think that it's labor underutilization is really what is the measure of slack in the economy that's going to affect wages growth, then that means if we've got to adjust down the rate of unemployment that we think's our target to capture the fact that for any given rate of unemployment, there's actually more labor underutilization. And of course, the RBA have talked about other structural factors, which they think mean that the rate of unemployment we can have without causing wage inflation is lower. I'm still, this latest episode hasn't changed my view on the target rate of unemployment at all. I think that, one benefit of the COVID period and the stimulus is that it's shown us that we can get the unemployment rate down without high wage inflation. Like before the latest lockdown, the June, we had unemployment of sort of below 4.6%, at the end of June. Wage inflation in the June quarter was only 0.44%. So I think, we've seen a pretty strong demonstration that we should be going for a lower rate of unemployment.
Well, I think that's a great point to end on, Jeff, and I think we'll all be watching to see how low we can go on unemployment in 2022. Thank you. That's University of Melbourne, Trueby Williams Professor of Economics and a CETA Director, Jeff Borland.